Welcome to On Mindfulness. This show is an offering of the Shasta Resilience Project, a group of trained and certified facilitators committed to bringing mindfulness approaches to our communities as ways of increasing well-being and decreasing stress. My name is Sharon Brizolair, and I'm your host and coordinator for the Shasta Resilience Project. Each month, we bring you interviews with wellness practitioners and residents who have found mindfulness and mind-body medicine useful in their lives and work. Today, our guest is Amy Cavallari, and she has been a leader in really spearheading bringing this offering to our county. And I'm really pleased to talk to her today about her experiences with the program as participant and facilitator, and to share some tools with you in conversation with her. So welcome, Amy.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So we like to begin with you telling us a little bit about yourself, your work, your roles, whatever it is you feel is important to share with listeners.
Sure. So I have been in Shasta County for the majority of my life. I graduated from high school here and then left and swore I would never come back here again in 2003, and have been here ever since. I really love the area. I am a nonprofit consultant, so I do work with a variety of different organizations in town on a lot of different things. It could be fundraising, it could be grant writing, program management, kind of association management type stuff. And I came into this work with the Center for Mind-Body Medicine after the car fire, and was kind of instrumental in working with the Shasta Health Assessment and Redesign Collaborative, also known as SHARC, helping them with raising money and establishing community collaboration around really figuring out how our community is going to be able to respond and really thrive after that collective trauma that we all experienced. And so I went through the training myself, and then also, you know, was helped to train other people in the community as well. So,
And you're probably the only person in the county who's worked directly with the Center for Mind-Body Medicine too. Is that right?
Yeah, I was on staff with the center for about 3 years as a development director, and was raising grants, raising money and writing grants and building partnerships really for their programming all over the world. And it was fabulous work. They do just amazing things in all different corners of the world. They're doing work in Ukraine. They've worked extensively in Gaza. They went into Florida, you know, following the school shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School years ago. All different pockets of our world that have experienced collective community trauma and have really been impactful in helping communities manage all the emotion that comes from those really tricky experiences.
And the center offers a range of different courses and experiences, right? Did you work primarily with the mind-body medicine work, or were you involved in some of their other offerings?
Yeah, primarily they are doing mind-body medicine work, and that was the work that I was supporting. And so one of the last projects I worked on with them was in the prison system in Indiana, which was kind of groundbreaking. We were training not only staff members, but also inmates simultaneously on how to use these skills and how to facilitate groups with their peers. So it could be staff or inmate peers, but really just kind of a holistic approach to the jail or the prison facility to make sure that hopefully everyone, staff and inmates, would you know, be able to benefit from these skills, because we know that, you know, the life of an inmate has particular stressors, and certainly the life of a correctional officer does as well.
Yeah, that's really interesting. In our county, we're in conversation right now with the juvenile rehabilitation facility and bringing that work to youth in the center, as well as to parents and caregivers who have children in the system too.
Yeah, it's been interesting watching the work of the center evolve. You know, historically, they have really come into communities following a collective trauma, be that a natural disaster or a mass casualty event of some sort. But what we're learning and what we now know really is that trauma comes to everyone, right? Mm-hmm. It's not, unfortunately, a unique experience. Our traumas all look and feel a little bit different, but the emotions behind those traumas are universal. And so these skills are just applicable really for everyone. So when I talk about, when I talk to people who are thinking about joining a group, I always tell them there's no such thing as a wrong person to join a mind body skills group, because I think the skills are really helpful and applicable for all of us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I've seen, and my guess is you've probably seen in your groups too, people who come in, sometimes come in, things are going, feel like they're going pretty well for them, but just to develop those skills for the next time that there's something difficult to navigate. Have you seen that?
Yeah, well, and it's interesting because I've been doing the groups since, I guess I did my first group in 2019. And my first group was about, I would say 50 or 60% of my participants were car fire survivors, so people who lost their homes. And interestingly, it was pretty fresh at that time. You know, it was less than a year after the fire. And interestingly, hardly anybody talked about the fire in that group. There was a lot of stuff that came up. It was mentioned here and there, but that's not what people really were talking about in that particular group. But over the years, since I've been leading these groups, I think pretty much every group I've led has had at least one person, one fire survivor in there. Mm. And it always comes up, you know, and we're here, five years later now. People still kind of managing that experience. And everybody, you know, works on their trauma at a different pace. And so, you know, it's not surprising, but it is just interesting to me that, you know, that first group so soon after the car fire was really like anticipating, gosh, we're going to talk about nothing but the car fire. Mm-hmm. But it really wasn't the case. And now it just, you know, it pops up because I guess people are finally have realized that there's some stuff there that they need to learn how to manage in a healthier way.
Yeah, that's really an interesting point you're making about people navigating trauma at their own pace, mm-hmm. their own way. And I was sharing with someone that I was told after the car fire, you know, you can think about it like letting air out of a tire. Maybe you do it little by little, you know, each time you go through therapy or discussion. And it also strikes me the stories we're seeing on public radio and other places talking to survivors of the campfire, mm-hmm. mostly about what the newest fires in Maui are bringing up for people again. And certainly we have lots of opportunities, lots of triggers that mm-hmm. are reminders of those emotions. Yeah,
definitely. I think my parents lost their home in the Jones Valley fire, which in Palo Cedro, which was, I think, the year 2000. Mm-hmm. And so when the car fire came through, I had no real, it wasn't really on my radar that how impactful that experience was for me until the car fire came through and I was terrified. I wasn't in any immediate danger. We lived on the east side of town at the time. There was flame, you know, the flames were not anywhere near being a direct threat for us, but I just could not relax unless I was sitting in front of the TV watching the news, making sure I was watching the trajectory of that fire every moment of the day. Right. And I actually ended up leaving town. I packed up my kids and left because I couldn't physically sit in this space and wonder if I was safe or not. Mm-hmm. And it was just an interesting experience. Like, oh, well, maybe there's some residual feelings about that experience.
Yeah. Well, and that's such a great illustration too. In our first episode, we were talking to Doreen Bradshaw, who you know, and just really looking at that community level trauma and that acknowledgement that even if you didn't have to evacuate, even if you didn't, or your family wasn't directly affected in terms of losing things, we were all impacted by by the notices, by the wondering, by the uncertainty, by what we saw and smelled, all of those things.
Yeah, absolutely. And we actually, I just had a fire in my neighborhood last week. It was a couple doors down from me, and I heard the fire trucks roaring in with their sirens blaring, and I ran out real quick to see what was going on. And, you know, it felt like the whole neighborhood was kind of out looky-looing, like, what in the world? You know, everyone's trying to figure out what's going on. And then I stood there for a second and I was like, okay, this is a fire. And then I'm looking, I'm like, why is everyone just standing here? Like, why are you not in your house packing up your stuff? Like, we know how this goes, people. Come on.
I can just see you doing that.
Yeah, people. And I did. I mean, I stood there for like 30 seconds. I was like, okay, well, I'm going to get my cat carriers down and put my computer in the car.
So it was a while ago when you mentioned, you know, having been trained and run your first group in 2019. Can you remember when you first learned about mind-body medicine and the center's work?
Yeah, I think it was, you know, during one of the SHARC meetings, the Healthcare Collaborative, right, you know, like the week after the car fire, I was doing some work with Doreen, helping to support that committee. And the discussion there was really focused on, you know, what are we going to do as a medical community to help support the emotional wellness of our community? Because this is a collective trauma. Like, they recognized that obviously right off the bat. And so Doreen, you know, contacted her colleagues in Sonoma because they had just gone through the Tubbs fire the year before. They had been implementing the Center for Mind Body Medicine model in Sonoma. It looked really promising, and the research on the model was really impressive. But we really wanted to send some Shasta County people down to get trained, to really kind of absorb it and check it out and make sure that maybe this was something that would work in Shasta County. And so I volunteered to go. I had no prior experience in leading groups. I had no real interest in doing any of the direct services stuff. Like, I'm usually more like administration, behind the scenes kind of stuff, like logistics. That's all in my wheelhouse. This whole touchy-feely, like personal stuff, I was like, I'll go to the training and I'll check it out, but I'm not going to do this stuff. You know, that was the attitude that I kind of went in with. And I only went because everyone was so busy and up to their eyeballs at that time, right after the fire, that no one else could really volunteer to take, you know, 4 days away and check it out. And so I went to the training in Sonoma, obviously, you know, with the, in my mind was just, you know, how's this going to look and feel in Shasta County? That was really the kind of the question I was hoping to answer. And it became quickly apparent as I was there that I was really there for myself. And I think that's an experience that a lot of people have when you go through the training with the Center for Mind Body Medicine, is that you come in with these ideas about how it's going to impact and benefit your community or other people, and you really just get so much out of it for yourself. I had a pretty transformative experience during that 4-day training and was really sold on it. And there was three of us that went down from Shasta County at that time to get trained down in Sonoma. And all three of us had similar experiences where we came back just really energized and absolutely convinced that the model was appropriate and applicable for people of all walks of life. And then just that really, I think that energy kind of helped light the fire to, you know, build the collaboration and raise the money necessary to bring it on a larger scale into Shasta County.
I wonder, what was it that really resonated with you or made you feel like, oh yeah, this is helpful for me and it would be helpful for my community?
Well, I think because when I went into the training experience, I was a bit of a skeptic. I mean, I had gone through their website with a fine tooth comb. I had looked at all the research, and like on paper, it looked good. But then I was watching, you know, some of the videos where they were interviewing participants who had been through the training program and just like couldn't, they're falling all over themselves talking about how great it is. And I was like, I don't know, like it seems a little too good to be true. Like, I don't really get it. I didn't have any kind of mindfulness or meditation practice in my life at that time. It was just completely something foreign to me. And so, but I remember sitting in the first group and our facilitator just really encouraged us to, you know, come with your empty cup and be open to the process. And, you know, you're going to get out of it, what you put into it kind of thing, all that stuff that we, you know, we tell our adult learners these experiences. And I just remember saying, you know, I think this is maybe a little bit woo-woo and crazy, but I'm just going to relax and open myself up into this process, right? If I'm going to be here for these 4 days, I'm going to be here 100% and I'm going to give it my, you know, give it the old college try and see how it goes and not sit back and try to be a skeptic or a cynic and, you know, poke holes in it. Like, I'll just be here. I'll just really try my best to be present and experience it to the fullest. And I mean, there's so much that went on during that training. I was, you know, struggling with some really challenging personal decisions and just feeling at a loss. I guess at that moment in my life, I felt like I had lost who I was, really, like who I was meant to be on this earth. I just felt very disconnected with, you know, everything. Like, what is my purpose in this world? And I was drowning in, you know, the challenges that we all have of parenting young children and balancing a career and, you know, keeping my marriage together and all those things that just feel really overwhelming in that season of life. And I really was able to gain some clarity. And then some of the skills that we learned, I remember within the first hour or two of the training, when we first arrived, we did this shaking and dancing exercise, which, you know, a little quirky, and it was probably like the most uncomfortable 7 minutes of my life, where you're in this room with 100 people and they told us, like, close your eyes, now shake your body. I'm like, really, in front of all these people? But I did it. And then I did it every day that week. And by the end of the week, it was one of my favorite, active meditations, I think, was one of my favorite things that I learned there. Even though the first experience I had with it was probably one of the most uncomfortable experiences, just because it felt awkward in this room with all these people and I don't know what I'm doing and what is this really supposed to do for my body or my brain. But then I just, you know, kept trying it. And that's what they say too, is just, you know, if you have a bad experience or a difficult experience one day, try it again the next day, or try it at a different time of day. And, you know, it might feel differently. And sure enough, it does. And it's still to this day, one of my favorite practices.
Yeah, I often share that with people too. And just for listeners who haven't been in a group, you wouldn't be with 100 people for one. And right, there are a lot of things that we do, whether on Zoom or face-to-face, where, you know, we have people look a different way. They could shake a dance when nobody's watching you. But I had a similar experience in my training where there were a couple of things. And I truly believe in having a beginner's mind and curiosity as a really critical way of learning all kinds of things. We didn't land in the car fire, and that was the first experience we had with challenges or trauma. But there were quite a few things that initially I found myself inwardly rolling my eyes or like, well, I'll try it this time. And those often were ones that proved super helpful later.
The piece that's striking to me, you know, there was definitely a lot of benefit and insight and things that I gained initially coming into learning the model. But as you say, like, as I've used it over the years, different seasons of my life, it's just really, I find it popping up in different places. Like, gosh, you know, if I had gone through this experience without my, you know, experience with mind body medicine, how different it would have gone. And I mean, I can give one specific example I can think of is, my mom passed away a couple of years ago from cancer, and watching her go through that process, and really walking with my family together through that process was such a different experience, I think, than it would have been otherwise. I just felt, you know, obviously there's grief in that process, but also, you know, just a lot of joy and gratitude in the relationship that I had with my mom. But I remember a lot of instances, particularly with my dad, and sitting, you know, after she passed away, like every time we would talk about her, he would get choked up, or start to cry. And I was able to just sit there and hold space for that. And I don't know that I would have done that. I don't know that I would have been able to do that, really without all this experience of groups of, you know, allowing people to have emotion and being comfortable holding that space and not trying to fix people when those big emotions come leaking out of their eyes. And I think it just made it maybe a richer experience for both of us that, you know, he felt comfortable enough to just let those emotions flow. And I could just sit there for, you know, a minute or however long he needed and then continue the conversation.
And that is a really important and distinctive part of those offerings that I appreciate as well. The no interrupting advice, intervention. And for many people who are used to being those helpers, it can be uncomfortable to not comfort someone, but also very freeing.
There was a great quote I found recently about, you know, people don't want to be rescued. They want to be witnessed. I thought that was such a powerful, just a powerful thought about, it's true. And I usually in my groups, I ask people to think about, you know, when you're having a tough time or you're having a problem that you want to solve or a question you're having trouble answering, like think of the person in your life that you would go to talk to, right? And they conjure up this image of whoever that person is for them in their life. And then I ask them to think about, like, what are the characteristics of that person? Why would you choose them to talk to when you're having a challenge or a question or problem? And you people always talk about, like, oh, they're good listeners and they're respectful and blah, blah, blah. No one ever says, because they're going to tell me what to do or they're going to fix me or, you know, like no one ever brings that stuff up, right? So then I flip it back and I say, okay, I want you to remember that because that's not what you want when you're in a position, when you're in a difficult position. You all talked about, like, you want someone to listen, you want someone to be supportive, you want someone to, you know, all these things. Nobody mentioned that they're looking for somebody to give them the answer or fix them.
Right. And even when they say, or even myself, you know, I say that's what I want, but it's not really what I want. It's, you know, I want your, you know, maybe your ideas, but then I'm going to think, yeah, is that right for me?
Yeah. Or I love the idea too, of even when we have some of those more difficult conversations with our friends or family, it's like, just vocalizing, like, okay, what are we doing here? Like, do you need me to listen or do you want to problem solve? Right. And you don't have to guess what people need, because sometimes you really do, like, gosh, I just really need somebody to bounce some ideas around. What I've found for me personally and what I've observed in my groups is that a lot of people really find that sharing piece to be the most powerful piece of their group experience, which is ironic because when people join a group initially, 9 times out of 10, that's the part that they don't want to do, or the part that they're excited about is like, well, okay, I guess I'll, you know, I have, as long as I have the option to pass, then I guess I'll still join the group, you know? But as people get into it and start to develop, you know, a level of trust with their fellow group members and realize the power there is in being able to just speak your truth out into the world without anybody telling you what to do, no one's interrupting you, no one's trying to fix you. Just what a powerful experience that is and what a unique experience it is. Kind of unfortunately, you know, oftentimes when we're in conversation with our friends and family, a lot of times our brain is always going to, like, what we're going to say next instead of really being fully present and listening to what the person speaking is actually saying. So I think that's powerful. And then people, it's interesting too, because a lot of times, like, just that sitting and listening can sometimes be the hardest part for people. Because they want to hug people or comfort them or, you know, tell them about, well, gosh, when my sister was struggling with depression, this is what worked for her, you know, that kind of thing. And we shut all that kind of conversation down because it really just detracts from whoever's speaking, like just being able to, again, put their truth out into the world and let it sit, you know, with no real expectation. And really coming to our own answers, our own wisdom, our own conclusions, and each person kind of being responsible for listening to that inner voice and that inner wisdom. And they always find it, always.
So, yeah, you're reminding me of an experience I had early on facilitating a group, and it was by Zoom, and someone passed several times and said, I have things going on, but I don't want to share. And we said, that's fine. And eventually they said, okay, I want to share, but I'm going to turn my video off. And we all said, fine. And then they shared what was really bothering them. And the experience was really powerful because you could sense the witnessing, the compassion, the yes, you still belong, and people had shared similar struggles, and it seems so freeing for that person. Yeah, it really opened some doors for the other people as well.
Yeah, I've had similar experiences where people, you know, hold back a little bit, you know, through the various opportunities to share. You know, we always say you got to let go and trust the model and not worry about, you know, what type of experience your participants are having, because they're there, and then they will have whatever experience they're going to have. Right? We do our best to facilitate opportunity for great experiences. And, you know, in my experience, I've never ever had anyone get to the end of an 8-week group and say, you know, this wasn't worth my time, or I'm disappointed. I've never heard that ever.
Yeah, no, me neither.
Multiple people who have said, you know, it's life changing and life giving. I hear that it's not infrequent. So it's great, great model.
Yeah. You know, the other thing about the model is that the facilitator is also a participant. In that when there's a check-in, you share. So it's a dual role. And I was going to ask you, what draws you to continue to facilitate groups? What do you like about that experience, that level of engagement?
I think as a facilitator, it holds me accountable to remembering to use the skills. You know, I think sometimes people assume, since I'm a group facilitator, like, oh, you must have this perfect self-care routine. You do these things every day. You manage your stress perfectly. That's not necessarily the case. I would say my personal self-care routine kind of ebbs and flows. There's times when I'm really faithful about, you know, doing breathing or meditation or whatnot on a fairly regular basis. And there's sometimes I completely fall off the wagon and don't do anything for months at a time. So every time I have a group, it gets me back into that rhythm of, okay, I know I'm going to have these intentional 2 hours once a week. I'm also going to be held accountable for a little bit of homework, like practicing a specific skill each week. So it just helps keep me on the rails, so to speak, of, oh yeah, gosh, this stuff really does work. I really should do this on a more regular basis. And it's just, it blows my mind every single time, every single group. You know, it's this random group of strangers that comes together, don't know anything. Usually they don't know each other. And just the community that's able to grow in that space, just every single time it blows my mind. I mean, I'm not surprised by it anymore because I know it's going to happen, but it's just, it's phenomenal. It's such a unique experience, I think, in our modern world to unplug for 2 hours and just really be able to build authentic connection with this group of strangers, in a fairly, you know, it's low tech. It doesn't require, you know, you purchasing a new toy or tool or anything. It's just all plug and play skills that really are accessible to anyone. And how rich that experience is for people.
Yeah. And we're going to practice one of the core experiences in a little bit here, but I wanted to go back to your self-identification as a skeptic. and there are many people who, you know, some people are very open. Well, let me try it. And if it works for me, great. And if, you know, something doesn't work for me, I'm going to experiment with things that might help. And other people want to know more about the science, like prove to me that it works. And so I wonder for you, and also what you've observed with participants, that role of the didactics or some of the background on each tool, what role that's played.
I think, like you said, you know, there's people who learn in different ways. Like some people want to experience it, and some people really want to know the science behind it. I almost always have somebody in my group who's madly taking notes about everything in the didactic. It always kind of makes me a little nervous because I'm like, gosh, I hope I'm not misquoting any of these studies or whatever. But I think there are some people who just need that concrete level of kind of proof, I guess, before they're really going to buy in or try something new like this. And that's okay, because we all, you know, we all learn and absorb information in different ways. And I think also the didactics, like, I'm not a huge data nerd, but I do find the research studies on mind-body medicine to be fairly fascinating, because, and it also makes me wonder about how do we get so far off base in, you know, our modern world of every time we go to the doctor and something's wrong, either we need a surgery or we need a pill to fix it. Like there's just so much power, I think, that we have to really impact our own health and healing. I mean, obviously, if we break our leg, we're not going to go meditate ourselves out of that. But right. There really is, there's a lot of time and place for this type of approach in promoting our own health. And I think it's unfortunate that it's not more mainstream, but I do think that's shifting. Which is fabulous. And, you know, the more we can help people experience positive shifts, I think the more believers we'll have. And hopefully, you know, our overall health as a community then will improve as well.
Yeah, you're reminding me of, I served as a program evaluator for a California endowment initiative locally. And one of the strategies was to really engage health providers in writing prescriptions for exercise and being, you know, not going to the gym, but walking every day for 10 minutes or parking farther. It's simple things that people could do, really acknowledging how much we rely on what the doctor tells us or what they can give us. And certainly there's a lot of information in the model about the health benefits of so many of those tools. And you were going to lead us through soft belly breathing. And so before you do, is there anything you'd like to share with listeners to kind of set up why we're doing this, why it's a core practice?
The soft belly breathing is one of the kind of the simplest skill, I guess, that we usually practice together in a group. And a lot of times it's one of the most impactful. I think it's portable. You can do it anywhere, anytime. I mean, some people report that they do soft belly breathing in the car when they're stuck in traffic, which is fabulous. Just make sure you don't close your eyes when you're doing it in the car. Right. You know, the first group I led, I remember I said, you know, we always do soft belly breathing on week one. And, you know, I encouraged everybody, you know, find 5 or 10 minutes in your day. And, you know, either when you wake up or at lunchtime or before you go to bed, wherever it works for you, and just like do this soft belly breathing exercise. And then somebody came back the next week and said, I didn't have 5 or 10 minutes to do it, but man, I did it, you know, during stressful times during my day at work, you know, while he was still working, just really noticing his breath and being mindful of deepening his breath and really helping to relax his body, and what a difference he noticed even with that, you know. So it doesn't have to be, 5 or 10 minutes or 20 minutes, whatever you have, that's all great. But you know, if you have 30 seconds in the middle of a stressful day, that can be impactful as well.
You're making me think of a little 3-minute video that I have that we can share that people can experience that difference in a short time. Well, so Amy, I'll hand it off to you. I'll put on a little music so those who tune in when you're being quiet know that we're here, that there'll be something. And I will start that in just a second and let you begin.
Okay. So I would just invite you to close your eyes if that feels comfortable for you. And if that's uncomfortable, you can just relax your gaze and maybe find something on the floor to focus your attention on. And then just become aware of your breath. Just start by not trying to change anything, but just noticing your breath. Just noticing the air moving in and out of your lungs. Be noticing if it's deep or shallow, fast or slow. And then gently, I want you to just deepen those breaths. Breathing in through your nose and out through your mouth. Allowing your belly to expand with each breath. We know as we deepen our breathing, it activates our vagus nerve, which is a wandering nerve. It runs from our abdomen all the way up into our brain stem. And it is the antidote to our fight or flight response. And we can calm that vagus nerve. It's continuing. Breathe in through your nose and out through your mouth. And as you're breathing, do you notice any piece of your body that's holding tension? And just maybe be intentional about breathing into that space in your body and exhaling out the tension that you're holding in whatever space that is. Sometimes we hold tension in our shoulders or our neck, or even our jaw or our lower back. Just continuing to breathe deeply and allowing our body to relax into this space. Sometimes as we practice this soft belly breathing and try to focus on our breath, other thoughts are competing for our attention. That's okay. It's our human instinct. It's our big human brain hard at work. When those distracting thoughts come, you can just notice them and gently let them go. Just return your attention to your breathing. In through your nose and out through your mouth. When you're ready, you can slowly just let your awareness come back into the space that you're in. Maybe wiggling your toes or your fingers, just becoming aware of the temperature of the air on your skin, any noises that are happening in your environment. And when you're ready, you can take one last deep breath in and open your eyes.
Thank you so much, Amy. And if you're just tuning in, you are listening to On Mindfulness, a show of the Shasta Resilience Project here on KKRN.org, broadcasting from Round Mountain, Bella Vista, and Redding as well. That was very nicely done. We typically don't do this by radio, so thank you for for playing with us. Not everyone knows, obviously, about mind-body medicine. You said you hadn't facilitated many groups, and my guess is there are many people who haven't been in groups or void groups. How do you typically explain a mind-body medicine group to people who are unfamiliar with it? You know, your elevator pitch for the groups.
Yeah, well, I always start with a caveat that this is not therapy. I'm not a clinician. I'm just there as a facilitator. And it's really a skills group, which I think is an important distinction because a lot of people call it a class. And in my mind, when I think of a class, I think of a professor in front of the classroom lecturing to the students. And that's not what this is. It's really an experience, a group experience. And so everyone is participating. I'm there as a facilitator to help guide the process, but I also participate as well. I usually just, you know, explain the general format of the group. You know, we open with a meditation, we have some sharing or check-in, we practice a skill together, and then we kind of like take some time to reflect on that, like what worked, what didn't, what challenges we had, what we loved, what we didn't like, and then a closing meditation. I always encourage people to come in with their empty cup, as we've talked about, like with an open mind, you know, and also encourage people to, you know, you get out of the group what you give to the group. And so if you come off or you come into the group closed-minded, skeptical, unsure, like that's okay. I mean, we welcome all of your emotions. But I think if you come in just open to the experience of learning something new, you'll have a much richer experience. And even myself, you know, I've been doing this for a number of years now. Every group experience for me is different for a couple of reasons. One, because, you know, my life is at a different phase. Every time I do a group, there's different challenges and different things that are going on that I bring into the group. And every time that, you know, the group participants is different as well. And those people really enrich the experience of the group. So, yeah. And I always warn people that, particularly in an 8-week group, I mean, there's a lot of different skills that we practice and learn together. And I 100% guarantee if you join an 8-week group, there's going to be something in that mix that you don't like, that doesn't click with you, that doesn't work, that you don't enjoy, that feels uncomfortable. But I always, you know, just warn people about that in advance. Like, you're not going to love everything. So what I just encourage people to do is, again, try it on for size. Take it home, practice it for a week. If you still hate it at the end of the week, fine, let it go. Like, but a lot of times people, when they go home and they really try to practice a skill, you know, different times a day, or depending upon, you know, maybe they're experiencing different emotions throughout the week, they find, gosh, you know, when I'm feeling really tired, this one helps me energize. Or when I'm feeling really stressed, this one helps me relax, or whatever it might be. It's just a learning process. It's really slowing down and taking time to notice what works and what doesn't, and then being able to have the tools and resources available to be intentional about building an effective kind of self-care routine for yourself.
Yeah, it's interesting. Because I'm teaching currently out of the college, and the parallels between coming to a discipline or a course that's completely new to you, that's uncomfortable too. There's a different language. There's a different way of walking into it. Any new habit takes a bit to figure out and to see what resonates with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
What misconceptions do you encounter? Like when people hear you and they're like, okay, Amy, And maybe they come, what kind of like internal barriers do you find are common?
Gosh, there's a lot, really. I mean, I have some people that struggle with religion and spirituality and how those two might intersect. That's an interesting one. People who are deeply committed to their own religious practices, whatever those might be, often wonder how or if this might mesh with their religious views or not. You know, they're wondering if.
Well, the mindfulness practices or meditation practices, that kind of thing.
Right. Yeah. So does people often wonder if that's going to be in contradiction to, you know, something with their religious beliefs. And I really, you know, prayer is a form of meditation. We don't do prayer in the midst of this group. But I think, you know, I think of religion as kind of an organized way of incorporating spiritual tools into our life. And I see mind body medicine as really just another collection of tools that's not necessarily tied to a religion or a deity or a belief system of any kind. It's really tied to science and what we know about how our physiology works and things that we can do to help improve our physiological response to stress. Another thing I commonly get is, you know, people just think it's a bunch of woo-woo BS, you know. I don't know, like that's for hippies. Like, I'm not really into that.
You know, all meditation, right?
Right. Like, that sounds like new age stuff that doesn't really apply to me or whatever. I get that a lot, and that's fine. Like, I welcome the skeptics. I was a skeptic myself. I'm like, you know what? Try it. If it doesn't work for you, great. But if it works for you, then even better, right? And I've never had anybody, like I said, I've never had anyone complete a group. And at the end of the week, 8 weeks, say, I wish I didn't do that. Or that was a waste of time. That never right. happened. So I just encourage, like, even if you don't believe it, you think it's a bunch of wacko BS, like, you know, give it a try. And it's funny, I think, I kind of came into that philosophy, you know, dealing with, you know, thinking about different ways to approach diet and food and all this stuff. And I was, you know, years ago, I started reading about diet and nutrition and all these, you know, like the paleo diet and the keto diet. And I was like, gosh, is this, you know, some really remarkable results that have been documented from people just switching up their nutrition or their diet. You know, same kind of thing was being preached in that corner of the, you know, the nutrition world of like, you know, maybe it doesn't make sense. Maybe it seems hard. Maybe it seems impossible or unlikely that this would really have a measurable impact on your physical health, but like, fine, just try it for 30 days and see what it feels like to, you know, quit caffeine or increase your fruits and vegetables or whatever that might be.
Yeah. So the role of just experiencing it so you can decide for yourself, give it enough time. In the group, you were saying, you know, practice for this week, check it out. And also that curiosity, which is such a important characteristic of lifelong learning, right? Being curious as opposed to shutting the doors too early or making a judgment before you have enough data or information.
Yeah, for sure.
Is there anything else? I mean, you just shared quite a few things, but anything else that you share with people who might be nervous about trying out a group or an offering?
I always like to just make them aware that while there is sharing in the group, people are always in control of what and how much they share. So there's never really a forced topic. Like, tonight we're going to talk about your relationship with your mother. Like, it's not like,
thank goodness.
Yeah, it's very open-ended. It's, you know, like, where are you tonight? What is going on with you? What emotions are present? That kind of thing. And it's, you know, so making people aware that, you know, we encourage and we offer space for everyone to share, but it's never required. And I would say, you know, 95% of the time, most people share, even the ones who come in and say, you know, tell me when I have, you know, I usually talk to people on the phone before placing them in a group. And I have a lot of people who tell me, well, I'm probably not going to say anything during the sharing. I was like, that's fine. You can still join the group. Mm-hmm. But I rarely have people who don't share during the group, because once you see other people doing it, it becomes more comfortable and more kind of a normalized thing. And, you know, for, like I said, when we're not giving advice, we're not fixing, we're just sitting and listening. It's a powerful experience. I mean, maybe it doesn't sound like much on paper, but to have a captive audience who's not interrupting or trying to fix you is really powerful.
Yeah. Well, and you make me think about being in groups as a participant, as a facilitator participant, and just how much you realize and learn when other people share. It reminds you of things in your life, or you experience empathy, or you realize you're not the only one who has had an experience or feeling about an experience, because it's our own experience of things that happen to us, how we interpret it, has its impact.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I've had lots of powerful experiences myself. I've observed, you know, lots of really powerful stuff with my participants. But for me, I think probably the most powerful experience I had was during a training. And so there was, you know, it was a small group of people who were all being trained to be facilitators, and we were taking turns facilitating with a, you know, a faculty member there to kind of help keep us on the rails and provide some guidance and feedback and whatnot. And I was in the middle of, I had just filed papers, officially signed papers for my divorce that day. And I came into group, and, you know, I had been separated for a while. I had made peace with that decision. But just the act of signing those papers was, you know, felt really heavy. So I brought it up in the group, and it kind of unexpectedly produced a lot of big emotion. And I just was, I completely, you know, lost it. I was crying. I couldn't speak. And the facilitator, you know, who was a trainee, right? We're all trainees. I felt like in that moment, like she and I were the only people in that room, because she was just sitting there, not saying a word, not looking away, but not, you know, not staring at me uncomfortable, but just sitting there calmly and letting me shed all these tears that needed to be shed. You know, in my mind, it felt like 5 minutes. It was maybe, you know, 30 or 40 seconds, who knows? and then, you know, and then I got it out, and the group moved on. And then at the end, when we were kind of debriefing and, you know, getting feedback on the facilitation, the facilitator she just was falling all over herself, apologizing, like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. Like, you brought up this big stuff and I didn't know how to deal with it. I didn't know what to say, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, you have nothing to apologize for. Like, you did exactly the right thing that I needed. That moment was all I needed to do, was vocalize and let those emotions leak out of my eyeballs for a few minutes. And then that's all I needed. You know, I didn't, there's nothing anybody could have done to fix or change that situation or that the emotion of that day. But just how beautifully she was able to just hold that space was amazing. So anyway, it's another kind of one of the big lessons that I've learned from this work, is like, don't ever underestimate the power of silence in your conversations. Because it can be so rich. It can often, you know, help the other person, you know, think and maybe continue the conversation, or allow that emotion that's behind their, you know, their conversation to bubble to the surface, and to look at it and feel it and experience that emotion, rather than, you know, punching it back down like a lot of people often do. So,
so beautifully said, Amy. you are offering a group soon, and it's full. I just wanted to check in with you. Do you have any others on the books? We'll share a link where people can sign up for a future group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I don't have anything else on the calendar. I mean, I'm sure I'll be, you know, continuing to offer groups, but I know the group starts in September. I would imagine I'll have another one in the spring sometime.
Okay. Well, and I'll definitely share the link and be reaching out to folks if we have a lot of people who want to experience something, 8-week group or some of our shorter offerings of 4 weeks, or we have a number of formats that they can find in that link. So I'd like to end by asking if there's anything else I should have asked you or that you wanted to share or that came up for you while we were speaking that you'd like to bring forth here.
I guess I just really want to emphasize, you know, people often ask me, you know, who's the target audience? Like, who should be in this group? And I will tell you, I've had every different type of person you could imagine. You know, I've had teenagers, I've had senior citizens, I've had people who are hippy dippy to the core and like have, you know, done meditation and all the mindfulness things like their entire life, and people who have never meditated ever. And all across the spectrum, it's been a meaningful and powerful and beneficial experience for all different types of people. So I really just would again like to say, like, there's no such thing as the wrong person to join a group. I really think that, again, trauma comes to all of us. We all experience stress. And as humans, we are not born really with fabulous skills on how to manage all the stress and trauma that comes to us in our modern world. And so if we aren't intentional about learning those skills for ourselves and also really teaching those skills to our next generation, to our kids, we've seen it, you know, time and time again of how trauma impacts, you know, if you experience trauma, you have higher rates of child abuse and higher rates of drug abuse and poor health outcomes. Like, all these things are intertwined. So if we can, I mean, just improve our ability to really manage all the things that come at us, it can have an actual impact on your overall physical health, which I think is kind of a miracle, because I think for so long, you know, we've been taught that if we're sick or we're hurting, that we need a pill or a surgery or something to help us feel better. And that may or may not be the case, kind of depending upon what you're struggling with. So it's certainly worth trying, I think, for pretty much everyone.
Well, thank you so much, Amy.
You're welcome.
You are listening to On Mindfulness, erin.org out of Bella Vista Round Mountain and our new studio in Redding, California. You'll see all kinds of links in our show notes about some of the things that Amy mentioned, how to get involved, and how to support KKRN. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. It was great chatting with you.